Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have as my guest Ron Kirchy, who is a poet who has been living for as long as I've known him in Pasadena. I've known his work since I arrived in Los Angeles 20 years ago. Now, it's a kind of marvelous thing. The strangest thing has happened. Billy Collins has become the nation's poet laureate. He used to be seen hanging around the poetry workshops in Los Angeles in those days at Beyond Baroque and other places. And it is no small coincidence that Ron Kirchy is one of Billy Collins' favorite poets. In fact, he includes three of Kirchy's poems so far in his Poetry 180, poems to be read one a day over the PA system in public schools. And it's because they're fun. And there was all of this poetry happening in Los Angeles that I didn't know how to take seriously or unseriously because it was so different from what I had been taught was poetry. That is to say, something I couldn't understand, something as difficult as opera, something that you had to acquire a taste for. And there was nothing that was required to read a Ron Kirchy poem. I thought that rather than ask him, why are your poems so easy to read and so much fun? I would let him begin with a rare, long, autobiographical poem called Why I Believe in God, Ron Kirchy.
I'd failed the examination allowing me to bypass the MA and go straight for a PhD. So I was obliged to let my friends forge ahead, reading, if possible, longer and fatter books than before, while I worked on something by the Pearl Poet for my thesis. My advisor was Mrs. Hamilton, a world-class medievalist and the most patient lady in the world. Every week I'd bring her a few pages of translation. She would smile and correct everything, and with her help, I finished. Now, an orals board consists of three members of the English department and someone from a different discipline, usually an assistant professor from chemistry who drinks coffee from a beaker. But my guy was from the German department. He had a scar, for God's sake, that might have come from a duel. He also wanted to begin because he had a few questions. What is the root word for this, he asked, and the root for that? And who in his right mind would mistake that for this? I glanced at Mrs. Hamilton, who looked like she was watching Thumper get hit by a tank. I took a deep breath and replied that I knew I was less prepared in German than I should have been, but German was the very next course I planned to take. I then hoped to move to Germany and become German. He sneered, but Dr. Rosenblatt, God bless him, asked me something easy. What was Eliot's first initial? Then Mrs. Hamilton wanted to know if Whitman had a beard. Yes or no would be enough. I was just getting my sea legs when Dr. Death leaned forward. What, he hissed, is the function of the ghost in Hamlet? Actually, he may have been trying to be nice because it isn't that hard a question. The ghost is the key that starts the engine of the play. Without him, Hamlet is just another pouty prince. But I froze. I couldn't think of anything. My teachers stared at me. They leaned forward encouragingly. Do you remember the ghost, Mr. Kirchy? Asked Mrs. Hamilton. Yes, ma'am. What was he in the play for? My mind was a blank. Less than a blank, a cipher. Less than a cipher, a black hole. And finally I piped, to scare people? They almost collapsed. Mrs. Hamilton put her head in her hands. Dr. Rosenblatt murmured, oh, my God. Then they sent me out of the room. I pictured myself selling aluminum siding or going into the army or both. And then I heard the arguing begin. Shakespeare had not been part of my coursework. I'd been blindsided from the beginning by an arrogant outsider. Mrs. Hamilton said she knew the German's publisher. All she had to do was pick up the phone and he would never see another word in print. They called me back in, said congratulations, and all but you know who, shook my hand. Mrs. Hamilton gave me a hug, said she'd never wanted a cocktail so badly in her life. I stepped outside into the Tucson heat. God was sitting on the steps in front of the administration building, staring at his sandals. "Ronald," he waved me over. "I protected you," he said, "when you drove home drunk. I introduced you to Betty Leffler, and I got you through that exam." "You know Betty? You were lonely." "Gosh, thanks." "You don't believe in me," he said, "but I believe in you, so I'm interested in what you plan to do next." "Not get a PhD. I'm a terrible student." "You're telling me." "I like writing poetry." God stood up. He had a great smile, and except for those sandals, a cool outfit. "Fine," he said, "be a poet. But don't say mean things about people in your poems. Be generous. Don't be deep or obscure. Try and make people laugh." And then, just before he disappeared, he kissed me. And that is why I am standing here tonight.
Ron Kirchee, reading from his newest collection, Geography of the Forehead. Geography of the Forehead was published by the University of Arkansas Press. Now, one of the things I've noticed as I've been going through what range from early pamphlets to full-fledged books is that the poems get rewritten as they appear from book to book, bearing testament to the fact that I've been told many times that it's not as easy as it sounds. What is the process by which a poem evolves?
Well, I'm just a hard worker. I'm a blue-collar guy. I met a new class last night, a new poetry writing class, and I told him I can drive a tractor. So that tractor and they were impressed. That tractor driving ethic, I think, is the same ethic that makes me revise and revise and revise. There's an old saw in writing that there's not any real writing, there's just revision. So 15 drafts is nothing for me. I almost never get a poem right out of the gate, as we say at the racetrack, my beloved racetrack. So it's just a matter of sitting down. And it's a little like, you know, sitting by a pool and seeing which body will float to the surface. I just wait and see which poem comes to the surface and wants my attention.
Now, it must have been pretty unusual to be writing poetry that was made, as Randall Jarrell said, for dogs and cats to understand. When you're coming out of a graduate program, and you're not, you know, Mr. Blue Collar. You went to an MA program. You do all the things that readers and writers do. Was it a battle to write the kind of poetry in the face of what was happening in poetry when you were coming up?
It wasn't for me. I mean, for one thing, I'm not all that smart. I mean, I remember I was in grad school in Arizona, and Jerry Lachlan was a pal of mine then, who still teaches at Cal State Long Beach. He's a terrific poet, must have 75 books to his credit. He introduced me to sending poems out for publication. We sent to the Wormwood Review together. This is 35, 37 years ago. And the kind of poem that I wrote then, a smarty pants, easygoing, long-lined, narrative-driven poem, is the kind of poem I'm writing now.
Mm-hmm.
I was never drawn to that sort of, you know, what I think I was. Rutke's a good poet, but we were reading Rutke in school, and I was struggling. And I was never drawn to that sort of thing, much less the T.S. Eliot kind of poem, of which I constantly make fun.
Are you hostile to them? Or
no.
Is it just another kind of poetry?
I can't do it, and they can. That's exactly right. That's why I don't write in fixed forms. They're too hard for me. You know, Tim Steele can do it. I can't do it.
Now, when you have poems that confess to being beautiful but dumb, like the poem that describes your poetry at a beauty pageant. And in fact, since I have it, it comes from Ron Kirchee's selected poems called Making Love to Roger's Wife, and it comes also from the University of Arkansas Press. No, it doesn't. It's the first poem in the new book.
In
Geography of the Forehead.
Oh, sure. Miss American Poetry.
Sure. Let's do that.
All right. At the contest in Atlantic City, my poems are surprised when a sestina isn't a nap after lunch. And they're amazed that blank verse is about anything at all. Things even get sticky at the mixer. A tall judge leers and says, So you're free verse. I've heard a lot about you. He leans in. I have a huge thesaurus up in my room. On the big day, my poems know world peace is the answer to every question. But in the talent portion, it's hard to see their wisps of irony, even from the good seats. Clutching the congeniality certificate, they fly home. Meanwhile, the local magazines are in the town square, smoking, revving their engines, combing their considerable hair.
Ron Kirchy, reading, is it called Miss American Poetry?
Miss American Poetry.
Now, after the initial years during which the first thing you would say about the poems was smart alecky, mm-hmm. the sweetness, which was always there in the poems, began to have more of a voice. And it seemed as if from the kind of grizzled Bukowski-like racetrack and cocktail lounge snarl, this guy who likes everyone to different degrees
yeah.
and with a certain amount of affection seems to have emerged in the poems, and with him more metaphors than used to be there and a whole weird, like, counter-vocabulary. You want poet? I'll give you poet. That kind of entered. What happened there?
About, I don't know what the years are, 10, 12, 15 years ago or something, it seemed to me that the kind of smarty pants poem I was writing, which was often fairly profane and more of a performance piece in the sense that I wanted to stand up in front of 50 people and, make them howl if I could. It seemed like a dead end to me. I'm looking back on this now. And although it's hard to, it wasn't articulatable in those days, I just sort of stopped writing. And one summer between teaching, I did nothing but write a sonnet a day. And I couldn't do anything else until I'd finished my sonnet. And it had to be a pretty good sonnet. It just couldn't be a crummy old sonnet. So I did it every day for almost 3 months. I didn't write anything else. I didn't read very much. I was going to track a lot, and I was doing this. At the end of the summer, I had a different sense of rhythm. I had a deeper sense of metaphor because I was writing sonnets and reading a few sonnets. And I'd become more egalitarian. You know, it was the egalitarian summer. And in a sense, I was sort of a different person. And this is around the time in my life when, I mean, it wasn't a dark night of the soul, but it was, you know, a penumbra. It was a dim night of the soul. I got divorced. My life changed. I was writing this sort of different way. I didn't set out to become a different person, but when that summer was over and I went back to work and I began to write again, I was a different person. So I wrote differently.
I'm talking to Ron Kirchy, by the way. His new book is Geography of the Forehead. It's a pleasure to have it. Recently, Dennis Cooper called it his favorite book of the year. And, you know, his is a name that in the near future, I think you'll be hearing more and more often. He wrote a novel called The Boogeyman. There are, on my shelves at home, innumerable chapbooks and magazines with special sections of Ron Kirchy poems. And you found at a certain point something that I think also gave a special tone of smart-alecky sweetness. You became a writer of young adult novels. I think the first one was Where the Kissing Never Stops, and the one I read most recently of the early ones is The Arizona Kid. But all these have the voices of young adults who find themselves the chinks in the system.
Right.
And what amused me is that in the same way that your poems use typographical errors as starting points, there's a whole book called Diary Cows, these kids are like the typographical error of the high school in a
right.
certain way.
What a nice thing to say.
Everything revolves around a slight mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these books have won all kinds of awards, including awards for the funniest book of the year,
right.
one of the 10 funniest books of the year. I thought that was a great award. how many of them are there now, and where are you? Because the newest one, which is called The Brimstone Journals, is truly dark.
Absolutely. It's the darkest thing I ever wrote. There's about 10 of these guys, and one coming out in May called Stoner and Spaz, which is just going to make the librarians, you know, swoon. It's about a girl who smokes way too much marijuana and about a boy with cerebral palsy.
Wow.
And it's not dark. It is a little dark, but it's very funny. It's very funny. And the young adult books came about in an interesting way. I'd written The Boogeyman, which I think you alluded to, and I thought I was going to be a grown-up novelist. That was maybe 20 years ago. The two books I wrote after that were terrible failures. And I was talking to a friend of mine named Meryl Gerber, who wrote YAs for a while. And she said, you should try these, Ron. She said, you're just, you know, you're incorrigible. You've never grown up. You can write in first person. And you could make $5,000-$6,000. Just, you know, you should just try it. So I went to the library. I looked at a couple. They seemed dishonest to me. They seemed formulaic. And I went home and I wrote Where the Kissing Never Stops, and I think it was ticked up by the second place my agent sent it to, and I sort of never looked back. So there's maybe 8 of these now.
But I keep thinking that writers go through so many hypothetical personalities before they end up. You know, the hypothetical personality of this book was one that was going to write a whole series mm-hmm. of devastatingly funny, sad novels. That would kill you over and over again,
right.
And it's kind of odd because I think the young adult books have those same qualities. They have that wild, hilarious sadness about them. They have better sex scenes than most adult novels do, and the compassion really can crawl all over you and make you sort of sob before you laugh again. Now, these things all seem exfoliations from the poems. The poems from the very beginning had all these qualities in them. And it's very hard to ask a writer, why do you think it took or it's taking so long for you to be a household name?
You know, I don't think about those things or worry about them very much. My life's been much more interesting than I ever thought it would have been. When I got married, I was going to stay married, and I didn't. When I was going to be a grown-up novelist, and I'm not. I never thought about writing as many poems as I have, but they keep beckoning to me. So all my plans have gone awry, but my life's been more interesting and diverse than I ever thought it was going to be. I assume that I'll soon be a household word. And then it'll be different, you know, and interesting in another way.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm speaking to Ron Kirchee. His most recent book is Geography of the Forehead, published by the University of Arkansas Press, who tell me that his new and selected poems, Making Love to Roger's Wife, is still available, but only in hardcover. Worth getting. Now, you have a poem, it's a come sort of famous in an underground, in which the students are writing their way out of a paper bag or
yeah.
trying to...
The title is a quotation, has quotes around it, and the little mini blurb says it's by anonymous. And here's the quotation, which is the title, and the poem follows. These students couldn't write their way out of a paper bag. I gather groups of freshmen. I distribute blue books and pens, and then I unveil the bag, big as a bus. They rush in, and I twist the opening. There is much unclassified argot and many contemporary shibboleths, but sure enough, nobody's writing his way out. Still, the bag is moving rhythmically. There are unified, coherent, and adequately developed moans, whatever they're doing as a beginning, middle, and end. I want to give you all A's, I shout, as the bag develops an afterglow and damp spots appear all over the place.
Ron Kirchee. Reading from Making Love to Roger's Wife. Now, I'm curious how you deal with students because, you see, if I came to you, I'd imagine what I'd have to unlearn is the tendency to think in James-structured sentences and to use words that no one uses in conversation. I grew up behind the pages of a book, and I grew up speaking in what I considered to be a kind of art speech, my own kind of aria, you know, made up of words that I never heard any aunts or uncles say. And I think I learned those words so that they would not understand me. My sense is that you teach people to write a whole different kind of poetry.
It's true. I was talking to the class last night, and I said I thought one of my jobs as we began to work together was to disabuse them of ideas about poetry. And I didn't want them to throw their ideas out, but to put mine next to them and see what happened. Most of my students work very high on the abstraction ladder. I told this story last night. This young man had a poem a year or so ago. It was very abstract, and no one could quite figure out what was going on. And they were trying, and I was trying to get them not to try so hard. And finally, I broke a rule, and I asked the kid what it was about. And he said, always said I was sitting in a bar called the Trocadero, and a beautiful girl came down the stairs, and she had a tank top on. She'd been dancing, and her midriff was all sweaty. He said, I just got so hot. Everybody in the room was riveted by this, whereas when he had read the poem, which may have been about his yearning loins as far as I know, their eyes were drifting all over. They were checking their watches, and they were wishing they were home watching Ally McBeal. His story, told sort of from the heart or from some lower organ, certainly got their attention. It was demotic, you know, in the best sense, that nice word. It was very straightforward. But he was talking to me casually, just the two of us. He had camouflaged this feeling and this event in what he thought was the garb of poetry. So I have to sort of get these people to take the heavy clothes off their poems because they come in very well-dressed.
Now, is it other poems that inspire you? It seems that these have their origins in stand-up comedy as well. And I wondered what have been the inspiration points.
There are other poems. I have books scattered around the couch where I sit and write. I'm liking Denise Duhamel very much. I read her poems a lot. David Kirby what's David's wife's name?
I don't know.
Yeah. Alphabet of Desire is the name of the book. Her. the Greek poet Kavafi is a wonderful poet. I read his poems over and over. I have some Chinese poems sitting around because I like that brevity and that concreteness. Jim Daniels, the poet from Pittsburgh or around Pittsburgh, I'm reading somebody all the time. And I'll often, someone, maybe it's Dana Gioia, says that at the beginning of a reading, a poet should read some poems by other people before he begins his own. And I tend to read poems out loud by other people, sort of to put myself in the... Remember in the old days when you were supposed to take girls home and put on a phonograph record and seduce them with music? Remember this routine? This is 40 years old. It's like Henry Mancini records would get people in the mood. I put myself in the mood. You know, I listen to the music on the page. I read out loud constantly. By the time I've read a couple of poems by Denise or Barbara Hamby is the woman's name, by Barbara or by David or by Charles Webb or by Billy, I'm in the mood, you know. I want to write. I want to do as well as my friends.
Well, that's great. What do you do if you don't understand a poem?
I leave it.
Just leave it?
I close the book, yeah. Uh-huh. I just close the book and go away.
Really?
Yeah. Not in that way that I would have if I were 25 and threatened by the poem. You know, it's just, that's not for me. It's like talking to somebody at a party and you begin the conversation and he uses a word like steed a pigeon and you think, whoops, you know, where's the guacamole? So I go for the guacamole.
Now, Billy Collins was someone that we in Los Angeles all knew because there were so many times that he'd show up at a Wednesday night workshop or here or there. And it really is the case. I mean, we do know that Lana Turner was discovered at Schwab's
in a
peculiar way. Do you feel the fact that Billy has become the poet laureate signals a new age or a new direction or a new kind of acceptance of a different kind of poetry?
I don't see how it can be helped. You know, even if people don't want it, I think it's imminent now. The 180 Project, you talked about exposing high school kids to these extremely listenable and readable poems. I think it's going to make an enormous impact. And all my friends who know I know Billy talk to me, and when I talk to Billy, I carry their greetings and their blessings. They're just thrilled. The idea that that poems, that sort of sweet-natured and easy to read, and yet, you know, lyrical and profound in their own way, are going to be out there because Billy reads a lot, is so heartening to most of us.
Let's end on a poem.
Sure.
Ron Kirchy.
I'm going to end with a poem that I used to end readings with when I was reading a lot from Making Love to Roger's Wife. I'm not an insomniac, but I'm a poor sleeper, and this poem is called A Guide to Refreshing Sleep. So although you're hearing this in the daytime, remember it tonight maybe if you wake up and see if it'll help. It's best to remember those nights when grown-ups were singing and breaking glass, and someone who smelled good carried you up hushed stairs towards strange cold bedrooms and launched you on a dark lake of coats. If that memory does not suffice, you may summon the obvious mascots of sleep, but forego counting them. It's miserly. They'll come. They'll stand by your bed, nodding their graceful Egyptian heads, inviting you across the crooked stile to one of those hamlets nestled between blue hills, where the curious are curious about sleep, the enthralled are enthralled with sleep, and the great conclusion is always, it's time for bed. Look, the cottage door stands open. On the nightstand is a single candle, yellow sheets are turned back, and in the garden are marshaled the best dreams in the world. Lie down. The horrible opera of the day is over. Close your eyes so the world that loves you can go to sleep too.
Ron Kirchy, that's a beautiful poem. Thank you. I want to do something that people tell me to do more frequently, but here I think it's virtually an operational necessity. I want to spell Ron Kirchy's name for you, which is Ron, it's obvious, Kirchy. K-O-E-R-T-G-E. This difficult name has been the subject of many of Ron Kirchy's poems, as you can imagine, and I wanted to let you know that his books can be found. You know, we have to dig for poetry books, but the University of Arkansas tells me they have a lot of these, too. Thank you very much for coming in and talking with
me. Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure.
You can read some poems from Geography of the Forehead on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse.